Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We had begun to consider the reason that Yahweh allowed the serpent, also known as Satan, into the enclosed garden of great joy. Why we discovered some weeks ago why there was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the midst of all of the trees that were good in the garden, which was to facilitate choice. But for those who would say that I cannot believe that God would allow anyone to corrupt his word when they're holding up their Bible, claiming that their Bible is the inerrant word of God. Newsflash, God specifically allowed Satan to slither into his garden. He permitted it. And the first thing that Satan did was twist what God said. And he allowed the woman, therefore humankind, to subtract from his instructions and to add to his instructions. So God deliberately, purposefully, overtly allowed both man and Satan to corrupt his testimony. It is the basis of religion. It has been going on ever since. Now, of course, the proof for this, beyond just this early story in the Torah saying that, yes, God did allow it, is that if you look at the difference between the text of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text, was kept and maintained in Babylon, and then in exile in Persia thereafter, finally brought back to the land. And then the Masoretes themselves, which are vocalizers of the text, the oldest extant manuscript that we can find from the Masoretes, which is the Masoretic text, dates to the 11th century, not BCE, CE of this era, about 1,000 years ago. And it became available to us about 150 years ago. It's the Codex Leningradus. The Dead Sea Scrolls date to as far back as 200 BCE, so they're 12 centuries older. They're the text as it was maintained in Yisrael as opposed to the text maintained in Babylon. If you compare the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Masoretic text, particularly in books where we have the entirety of the books, like the book of Yeshayahu, Isaiah, you'll find that one out of every 13 to 14 words is different. Now, that's not huge. One out of every 14 words, what's that, about 7% of the text is different. But that's a lot as well. When you go to the point of inerrancy, you know, a 7% discrepancy isn't inerrant, not even close. And that's just the fact. Now, even the Dead Sea Scrolls differ among themselves. And, of course, they differ from the Masoretic. And also, there are enormous differences in the English text that you read from the Masoretic. Because of the fact that when the most popular English translation, which would be the King James, was created, the Masoretic text was not known. You see, the King James is a translation out of the Latin, which was a translation out of Old Latin, which was a translation of the Septuagint, which was a translation into Greek out of Hebrew. So your King James is a translation four times over, bereft of the influence of the Masoretic text, even though that's what the prologue to many and the preface to many of these Bibles actually reads. Factually untrue. And then once the parlance became familiar, the publishers were unwilling to change it, even when the Masoretic showed that that was inappropriate, even when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Now, in addition to that, the Masoretic text is a vocalization whereby the Masoretes arbitrarily chose, for religious purposes, what vocalization suits their interest, as opposed to considering all of the implications from the whole of God's testimony and character. And that's the good news, that you know, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms probably differ in one word and seven when you consider the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls to the basis of English translations. And then you have the fact that about a third of the words are either errantly translated or inadequately translated. Which means of your Torah, prophets, and Psalms, what you read in English is, at best, 50% accurate. Now, if you move to the so-called Christian New Testament, everything Paul wrote was satanic. So that's half of the book right there. So half of it is not only not scripture, it's Satan's drivel. Paul admitted that he was demon-possessed. Read 2 Corinthians. He admitted that he was insane. His writings affirm it. But now of the remaining half, here's the problem. There are 300,000 known variants between the basis of English translations, which would be either the Textus Receptus or the Nestle Allen, depending on which variation, which text you're reading, and the oldest manuscripts. There's some 69 extant manuscripts that have been unearthed prior to the dominion of Constantine. Now, post-Constantine, there's virtually no textual fidelity. The text was augmented and changed as the religious saw fit. But prior to that, of the 69 pre-Constantine, pre-mid-4th century manuscripts, there's 300,000 known differences in a text of about 182,000 words. It isn't even remotely accurate. Not even remotely. On top of all of that, all the testimony from the eyewitnesses has been translated from Hebrew into Greek, losing value along the way, losing authenticity along the way, and then translated from Greek into English. So it's not just a matter of there's no way textually to know what was actually said. There is no recording of those conversations in the language they were actually spoken in. And then you have the grotesque twisting of things. You know, for example, a church. There's nothing remotely close to a church in the Greek text. And so, if you're looking at the so-called Christian New Testament, it may be as at the absolute most optimistic, 20% accurate, 80% errant. That's the facts. The facts are irrefutable. So if you're amongst those who are religious and you think that your holy Bible, like the commercial that we have played during the last break, that Obama is anti-biblical, well, even Bible is a corrupt term. God has no interest in a Bible. It's the name of a pagan sun goddess. And so if you're amongst those who have been deceived into thinking that your English translation is the inerrant word of God, God help you. Because you have swallowed the Kool-Aid that is laced with poison whole. It isn't even remotely close to being the truth. And realistically, and we have Larry on the line here, Yahweh had no choice. He has to let man corrupt his testimony. Has to. The moment he says, I'm not going to allow that, then he can't allow for free will. If God's going to say, you cannot misrepresent anything that I say, you can't truncate it, you can't augment it, you can't twist it, you can't mistranslate it, you have absolutely no say. Whatever I say, I'm going to make permanent inside of you so that you can't have anyone twist it. At that moment, free will is a sham. God is micromanaging. Larry, that's something he won't do, is it? Isn't it?
No, it isn't. I'd like to point something out. You know, you know, a church is based on a pagan goddess. Biblio is a pagan goddess. Holy is based on Helios, the sun god. On and on it goes.
Like
and
the Gratia, grace. Grace, I mean, that's actually the name of the pagan goddess. Easter right. is the name right. Of a pagan goddess.
Yeah, and yeah. In Dabarim, it says, surely the person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity, who oversteps right. their bounds and speaks words in my name, which I have not instructed nor directed them to speak, and who speaks in the name of other gods, Elohim, right. indeed, that prophet shall die. That's Dabarim, 18:20. Corrupted to Deuteronomy, by the way.
Right.
I want to read something here from one of these pre-Constantine parchments that Yada's talking about. It says, for the reason the Torah, through Moshe, was given, acceptance and truth through the Masiyah, Yahusha, came to exist. That's Yahokanan, which means right. Yahweh is merciful. Corrupted to John 1:17. Now your Bible version says this: the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Yeah. They do not say the same things.
Right.
We can go to Matanyahu. Not anyone calling me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but to the contrary, those in heaven are those who do my Father's will. Many will say to me in that specific day, Lord, Lord, did we not speak inspired utterances and prophesy in your name, drive out demons in your name, perform many mighty miracles in your name? And then at that time I will profess to them, I never knew them. You must all depart from me, those who bring about that which is in opposition to the Torah. That's yeah. Matanyahu 7:21-23.
Yeah. Yeah,
the Bible version says not everyone instead of not anyone. It says not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven,
right.
but only those who do the will of my Father in heaven. Many shall say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not drive out demons in your name, perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Now, you see, they replace those who are in opposition to the Torah to evildoers because the people that ran churches, these institutions named after a sun goddess, they could call anybody an evildoer that was in opposition to them. But it's people in opposition to the Torah will not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, but you know, Christians don't much like what Yahusha said. They don't much like Yahusha's name. And so they will almost always ignore what he said because they really prefer what Paul wrote. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Larry, in the last segment, shared with us a couple of profound insights. This one that was the last that he shared was a statement that Yahusha made during his Sermon on the Mount. And in it, he had just concluded a long explanation about trees and fruit. Now, he wasn't talking about how you would go off and become a fruit farmer. He was talking about that if a tree is rotten, if an individual is rotten, if an institution is rotten, he says there is a 0% chance that that rotten institution is going to produce something valuable. That 100% of that which is produced by a rotten institution is rotten. Because even when they occasionally say something that is true, the truth woven into the fabric of their lives only makes their lives look more appetizing. And it was an absolutely unequivocal discussion. Right? God's trying to make the point that this idea that there's good and bad in everything is a myth that will cost you your soul. You know, those that say, okay, I understand that parts of Paul's letters aren't very good, but some really good nurturing parts of it. So, you know, just let's take the good and leave off the bad. And what Paul's saying, that's just not the case. When lies are mixed with truth, all it does is makes the lies appear more appealing, more credible.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many hundreds of examples. I mean, one right off the top of my head. What is it when Paul describes love? It is not puffed up. It does not vaunt itself. It is not jealous. Now, let's go to the Torah. Yahweh says, I am a jealous God.
Right. Oh, of course.
So what? There's no love in him?
Right.
I mean, think everything he said, from the smallest to these giant things, were lies interwoven with truth. That's what
of course.
Was, every
right.
time.
Yeah, and of course, Paul was the most puffed up, egotistical man who ever attempted to speak for God. Whoever claimed to have...
He fulfilled the Messiah's role.
Right, of course. Yeah. So, it's absolutely true. If you are an informed and rational individual, you recognize that what Yahusha said is true. That someone who is rotten like Paul has absolutely no merit. That everything they say is poisonous, and it will kill you. It's interesting also that the first statement that Yahweh makes, not anyone calling me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who act upon my Father's will. The Father's will is presented in only one place.
The Torah.
The Torah. And the Father's will in the Torah is what?
It's Yahweh's will. That's what the Torah is. I'm sorry.
The reality is that the Torah begins with the covenant. It begins explaining the nature of the covenant relationship in the Garden of Eden, and then it continues to develop the covenant relationship with Noah and his family, and then it codifies, providing the terms and conditions as well as the benefits of the covenant relationship, as the opening book of the Torah progresses in the discussions with Abraham. And so God is direct. He begins right at the beginning, saying that... it's the covenant. In fact, even as he's talking about creation and he's speaking about the conception of life and then particularly about creating Adam in his image, all of that is what he revels in, which he calls good, which he gets down on his knees to lift up.
He said he made Adam?
Yeah,
for the purposes of association and companionship.
Right.
He didn't make him as a religious object.
No.
I mean, you know, his nature has changed in all these religious books. You know, instead of being Yahweh, he becomes a lord that lords over people.
So if we return...
By choice, he gives commandments.
Yeah,
he didn't lay any commandments out. He made statements of fact.
Right. And if you look at the statement then that Yahusha is delivering in the Sermon on the Mount, it is the ultimate choice. If you view God as a lord, which is Satan's title, someone who owns slaves who have to obey. If you view God, as Paul did, as a lord over slaves, then there is a 0% chance that you will enter heaven. None. But if you view God as your heavenly Father, and you embrace his will, which is for us to participate in the covenant relationship, then you will. It is, how do you view God? Do you view him as Father, or do you view him as Lord? If you view him as Lord, you're excluded. If you view him as Father, and you understand the terms and conditions of the covenant, you're included. But what's so interesting is what happens next. Christians don't listen to Yahusha. That's the point he's making, because they respond. After he said, no one calling me Lord, Lord is going to enter the kingdom of heaven, they respond, but Lord, Lord, didn't we do all of these things? Which proves the point. Christians don't listen. Welcome back to Shattering This. We have Deborah, Jason, and Larry on the line. We're going to begin with Deborah. She's calling in from Idaho. I understand you have a question or a comment on the book of Revelation. Welcome, Deborah.
Wanted to know about the authenticity of that particular manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
So much of us are you know, planning our lives around what's going to happen in the end times here,
yep.
and a lot of hysteria out there and everything based on that book.
Yep.
So I just wanted to know, how authentic is that manuscript, and when was it written? I know it was written by John, supposedly, but are there other cross references to the Torah as to the accuracy of that particular book?
Yeah, let's first consider when it was written. It was probably written in 69 CE. The scholars will tell you it was written around 90, but its opening lines about the nature of a ruler that was and will be, is and is not. The discussion is designed to use Nero as a prototype for the Torahless one, known as the Antichrist, and so it puts the writing at 69 CE. Yao Conan was obviously a trustworthy witness, and Yahusha is the speaker in much of it. So from that point of view, you would view it credibly. But here's the reality. Half of the third chapter is not extant in any pre-Constantine manuscript. Half of the fifth, the sixth, and the 15th chapters are omitted from any extant manuscript. We have nothing from the fourth chapter or the seventh prior to Constantine. We have nothing past the second verse of the 17th chapter through the end, which means that 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22, those chapters of Revelation, which combined with the others is half of the book, does not have any verification, any textual witness prior to the emergence of the Roman Catholic Church, when we enter a period of great textual liberty. So those are all issues. Now, much of Revelation actually speaks against Christianity and especially Roman Catholicism. So it is, and since the witness still speaks against those things, there is less likelihood, even though we don't have an old manuscript, that the words were corrupted to appeal to Roman Catholicism when it is an open condemnation against Roman Catholicism. My view is that, and the more I've studied, that Yahusha said almost nothing that wasn't previously recorded in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And my guess is that if we had a comprehensive understanding of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, what we'd find is that he said nothing that wasn't previously recorded in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And so if you're looking for what's going to happen, and you speak of the impending doom that is coming upon our planet, the timing of that is actually available in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and not specifically revealed in Revelation. For example, I can tell you for certain that Yahusha is returning, but as Yahweh, on year 6000 Yah on Yom Kippurim. On our calendar, that falls on October 2nd, 6:22 p.m. as the sun is setting in Jerusalem on October 2nd, 2033. That's when he's returning. 5 days later, we'll begin the millennial celebration of the Garden of Eden called Sukkah, and it will last for 1,000 years from year 6,000 Yah to year 7,000 Yah. That is discernible from the Torah and from the prophets and the Psalms. It is not discernible from the book of Revelation. But that's your timing. So you've got in 2013, you have 20 years. That is if you endure the last seven. Now the 7 years, while it is presented in Revelation, is also presented in the book of Daniel. So we have evidence of the 7 years in the book of Daniel, and we also have evidence of those that have elected to participate in the covenant being removed on Teruah prior to the beginning of the of this 7 year period. So while it's not a rapture, that's a Pauline term, and it's a very vicious term. It is a it is the Teruah harvest. God speaks of it in Yeshayahu, Isaiah, and elsewhere, and he's very explicit on removing his children from the earth prior to that 7 year hellacious period. So the very latest that we can be removed is 7 years before the beginning of the tribulation, and that means that rather than having 20 years, you have 13. So if you're trying to make plans as to how long you're going to help share the conditions of the covenant and its benefits with your family, with those that you've grown to know and love, with others that deserve to know the truth, you have 13 years. And if you're...
Is that strictly the 144,000, though, or no?
Yeah, we have a problem with the 144,000. It is extant in one place, not extant in the other as it relates to Revelation. And of course, it's translated not only into Greek, but there's the use of a lettering system to convey the numbering, and the lettering system is really subject to interpretation. Just as the alleged 666, it's a there's no Roman numerals or Greek numerals to convey that number, and so you really have to wonder is it in fact 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes? And if so, then it's that's going to be some fancy DNA work on behalf of Yahweh, because there is nobody that has any clue what tribe they would belong to. Now, if somebody tells you, I'm from the tribe of Loi, I'm from the tribe of Dan, I'm from the tribe of Yehuda, they're just utter speculation.
I have no idea about my background.
Yeah. So and most of us really don't know. So Yahweh says that. That one-third of the Jewish population, the Yehuda, Israelites, that enter the tribulation will survive it. One-third. And he could well, and he does not say what percentage of those, embrace him and have the covenant reconciled upon his return. But could that be 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes? Well, we know that the millennial celebration of Sukkah, Yahweh is going to reestablish natural-born Yehudim and Yisraelites in their original homes. And so there has to be a significant number of them. And so I'm sure it's possible, but he's speaking strictly of natural born, Yehudim and Yisraelites, that he is reconciling his relationship with upon his return. This is not a Goyim instruction, does not apply to us. The covenant applies to us, the Torah applies to us, but not to that particular, numbering. And also, just think about it for the moment, that there's probably 15, 16 million Israelites alive on the planet today. 144,000 amongst 16 million. It's a pretty small percentage.
Yeah.
And I think with the rest of us, the percentage is even smaller. Well, thank you, Deborah, for calling in. My pleasure. We have Jason, who is calling in from Toronto. Hello, Jason. Welcome back to Shattering Myths.
Hi, Adam. I had a question about the Hebrew text that we have now and how they're interpreted. Because I've lost a bit of confidence in them, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit. And one thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, first of all, let me say, again, my question, and that's regarding the lexicons and the interlinears.
Sure.
Don't the translations and the different English definitions we get from that, weren't they really come from, Masoretic and rabbi interpretations to begin with?
Yes and no. First of all, your overall concern is valid. If you want to know what God said, you really have to be willing to closely examine and carefully consider. Almost all interlinears are based on the Masoretic text. And so if you want to clean up the Masoretic text for what can be known from the Dead Sea Scrolls and turn back the clock 12 centuries, then you have to get something like a Dead Sea's Bible. What the Dead Sea's Bible will do is it's not going to give you a better translation, but the Dead Sea's Scrolls Bible will show you in italics every place that the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text differ. And they italicize the difference, and therefore, once you come to know Hebrew, you can read what is actually there and then find the Hebrew word that created that difference and then replace, correct the text doing that. And since about three-quarters of the Torah prophets and Psalms are available to us through the Dead Sea Scrolls, something from every book except Esther, I believe, is available to us. We can use that tool, but it takes time. You've got to be willing to invest the time. The second thing is that as it relates to the lexicons and the dictionaries, they're primarily based upon Christian publications because Christian publications is where the money is. There are too few religious Jews to justify large publications of lexicons and dictionaries. And so if you look at Strong's, which was kind of the father of them, Strong's was created to justify and explain the King James. And so the first definition in Strong's is almost always the King James, even if Strong's knows that that's not the definition of the word. And they'll list it, knowing full well that it's not accurate. But one of the things that Strong's was particularly good at is that he almost always went to the root, and in most Hebrew words, the root is the verbal form of the actionable form of the word, and the actionable form is much harder to corrupt over time. And so you can use the Strong's to get to the truth. Now, what I find is that if I've got five or six lexicons and dictionaries open simultaneously, and I take the time to look at the 22, you know, there's 22 letters in the Hebrew language, and they were all, they included five vowels so that every word can be pronounced. That if you look at those just at the characters themselves, and you eliminate the Masoretic diacritical marks or the vowel pointing, and you consider every potential meaning of a word bereft of the Masoretic vowel pointing, then you can always, almost always, find a meaning that is absolutely consistent with Yahweh's character and the content of the sentence you're evaluating. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the realization that our translations of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are errant, and that to come to know what God actually said requires a considerable investment in time, careful examination, diligent consideration. And Jason was bringing the point forward, and he's right, that the interlinears that we have available to us are based upon the Masoretic text. So to correct them, we have to turn to the Dead Sea Scrolls and find out where the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls differ. And then in translating, we're dependent upon lexicons and dictionaries, and the problem there is that very often the first definition is not a definition at all, but a justification for what you find in your English Bibles, and so you really have to do your homework. You've got to not use one lexicon, but a half a dozen at least, and you need to actually look down not as to how the word is most often translated, but what the primary, secondary, and tertiary readings, meanings of the words are, and in Hebrew, always looking to the verbal form of nouns to ascertain what the noun actually means. So with those insights, Jason, did that address your question, which is that unfortunately there's no easy answer for it? I mean, there's a direct answer. It's just that to do the job that you want, which is to have a reliable transcription of what God actually said, you really got to work at it. I don't hear Jason, but Jason, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you
okay.
hear me?
Yeah, I can now, Jason. Go ahead. Did that address your question, or you still have greater concerns?
Oh, well, I do wish that I was retired. I could spend a little more time.
Yes.
One thing that kind of, mm-hmm. you know, when I was considering how I was going to get a reliable interpretation of the words,
right,
how they're put together. One thing that jumped out at me was the pictograph stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then
right.
also when reading the text, sometimes you come across things like he named her Choa because she came from men. Or, you know, they'll give a name and they'll explain the reason for that name. And
right.
You almost get a definition of those group of letters.
Right. Correct.
Within the text itself, which I found really interesting.
Right. For all of our listeners here, what Jason is talking about is that the original alphabet, that in fact, man's first alphabet, the very basis of the word alphabet, is from the Aleph and Bet, the first two letters in the Hebrew alphabet. But the original Hebrew alphabet, which was the first alphabet ever used by man, is a pictographic alphabet. And so, for example, the Aleph is the picture of a ram's head with a ram's horn. It was the symbol of having the power and authority to do whatever was required, capability, if you will, and it also was symbolic of the Passover lamb. The next letter, Beth, was drawn in the form of a floor plan of a home with one way in. So it was a protective shelter, symbolic for family. In fact, Beth today is the Hebrew word for family. And so then you put the first two letters together, you have the Hebrew word for father, which is the one who can protect the home, the one who has the authority to build a home, and so by combining the symbolism of the letters, you come to understand the nature of the words, and you can look at a word like Beth, which adds the Rosh. The only difference between Beth and Bereth, which is the word for covenant, adds a Rosh, which means this is the first family. This is the most prioritized family, because the Rosh is the Hebrew word for first, but it was drawn in the form of a human head, which means that if you want to join this family, you got to use your eyes, your ears, your brain to absorb the information and process it, so you understand the nature of this family. And so you're right. You can use that to define words. And the thing that I found the most helpful is the second thing that you said, is that anytime there's a word that's important for us to know its meaning, when it's not immediately obvious, Yahweh almost always defines it in his first use. An example is on four of the seven Mikre. We're asked to answer God's invitation and to approach coming into the presence of the Isha, which is the maternal manifestation of God's light. God defines Isha right there in the garden, calling Chawa the Isha. She is and naming her Mother, the source of life. And so God defines his terms if we take the time to look at how he uses them in his own teaching. Thank you for the call, Jason. We'll be back with Shattering Myths tomorrow.